Welcome to the Quillette Podcast, hosted on alternate weeks by me, Jonathan Kay, and by Iona Italia. Quillette is where free thought lives. We are an independent grassroots platform for heterodox ideas and fearless commentary. You are about to hear a free preview of this week's episode. To hear the full episode and to get access to all our podcasts and articles, visit us at quillette.com and click the subscribe button.
I'm your host today, Iona Italia. My guest today is the writer, academic, and journalist Roya Hakakian. Roya is the author of three books. Her second book, Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, 2011, is an account of the murders of three Kurdish-Iranian activists in Berlin and its aftermath. Her third book, A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious, is a love letter to her adoptive nation. In addition to her books, Roya has produced an extensive body of writing that ranges from investigative journalism to Persian language poetry. She is also a founder member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. She has written several articles for Quillette and has previously appeared on our podcast to talk to my colleague Jonathan Kay about how an Iranian Islamist managed to infiltrate American academe. Today, I'm going to talk to Roya about her first book, Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran. The book provides a detailed account, deeply poetic, funny, and moving, of her experiences growing up as a member of Tehran's tiny but flourishing Jewish community, first under the Shah, then amid the fervor that accompanied the Islamic Revolution, and finally, amid the events that followed, which were both sinister and comically absurd. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Roya Hakakian.
So it's very interesting. I haven't talked about this book in a long, long time because I've had all these other books in between. So this, I haven't had interviews about this. I'm really looking forward to it. It's 20th anniversary.
Oh, yeah.
Of the release of this book. So.
Oh, wow. And you wrote it actually. So you wrote this book 20 years after the events that it describes. You begin the writing in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's at least when you're first contacted and asked whether you'd be interested in writing a memoir. And the events that you are describing take place largely in and around the year of the Iranian Revolution of 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the beginning of the book, you say, when you have been a refugee, abandon all your loves and belongings. Your memories become your belongings. Images of the past, snippets of old conversations, furnish the world within your mind. When you have nothing left to guard, you guard your memories. You guard them with silence. You do not draw your treasures into the light, lest exposure soften their sharp, sad, or gay details. The best lesson I ever learned from visiting museums. So I obviously know, but for our listeners, can you talk to us a little bit about what made you finally decide to write the memoir after 20 years?
Well, first of all, I was always very reluctant to write, primarily because I had always been a poet and up until this book, and I always wrote in Persian. So I felt that how dare I not just switch genres, but also switch languages. And so it was never in the cards that I was going to talk about anything that I had ever witnessed. But what convinced me was the rise of a reform movement in Iran. So in 1997, President Mohammad Khatami came to office and there was a huge celebration around his election, partly because he had really electrified a large portion of the Iranian society. And, you know, the youth, a lot of people were completely convinced that he was the reformist. He was the true face of a future Iran that would bear no resemblance or very little resemblance to what Iran had been up until then. And I remember thinking, even when everybody was elated, including, by the way, so many people in the West who thought, you know, he's talking about the dialogue of civilizations. He was very famous for being sort of the civilized new face of clergy in Iran. And one of the first things that he had said was that, you know, enough about isolation of Iran. I'm interested in initiating a dialogue among civilizations. And so everybody in the West was celebrating. So it was at that time that a New York Times editorial writer, a dear friend, reached out to me and said, you know, what do you think about all this? And so we got together and I said, I have very little hope that this man can change anything and that any reform can possibly take place in Iran. And while I said that, I also said that I hope I will be proven wrong. But based on what I know of Iran, based on what I have observed, and based on, you know, all the things that I have seen and read over the years, I see no possibility of this regime transforming itself in any way, shape, or form. And the editorial writer was someone who, like every other liberal in the West, was betting on Khatami to bring about change in Iran. So he challenged me. And there we began a very long series of conversations where he would ask me questions and I would answer, and they would go on and on, mostly via email, but every once in a while we would get together and talk in person, until one day he said, you know, you should really write all these things. You know, all these things that you've been telling me over all this time deserve to be on record. And so it was at that point that I thought maybe I had something important to say, it, by way of offering a different record and a different account of what had happened in Iran.
Yeah. So there are so many threads to the memoir that it's a little bit hard to know where to start, but perhaps we could start here, which is, I'm noticing a lot of people have been romanticizing the political conditions in Iran under the Shah prior to the revolution. And you talk about, so in some ways, of course, under the Shah, Iran was flourishing in certain regards. As you mentioned, the GDP was much higher than that of other Middle Eastern countries. Mm-hmm. There had also been advances in the emancipation and position of women.
Mm-hmm.
And at one stage, you talk about reading magazines and seeing these photos of Iranian women being the first woman to do various things, including one who is the queen of the nuclear reactor or something, the reactor queen. Yeah. And she is standing there surrounded by nuclear scientists. So this is quite topical at the moment. And you actually had, you tore out one of the pages, which was a photo of a woman who was the first long distance truck driver, standing mm-hmm. by her truck, and you said it, she was biting her lip in a slightly girlish manner, and she seemed like an ordinary girl, but she also had this amazing strength and defiance. So there were a lot of freedoms and economic prosperity, but nevertheless, life under the Shah should definitely not be romanticized. Do you want to talk a little bit about people's perceptions or misperceptions of that pre-revolutionary conditions in Iran?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you're correct in that there are a lot of people who are romanticizing life under the Shah, but there are also an equal number of people, especially among the diaspora, who spent their youth opposing the Shah, and they are dead set against giving up anything that they had ever thought in those days. In other words, it's become a holy matter. It's a sanctified subject that they are never willing to challenge, because it will then unravel a whole series of beliefs that they have had. Because you see, for a whole group of Iranian intellectuals, the Shah was a simple symbol of U.S. imperialism, and U.S. imperialism was at the time facing off against the Soviet Union, and so there was good and evil, and those who were communists and socialists in Iran saw the Shah in this much larger perspective, and therefore, you know, for a lot of people, objecting or reconsidering their past beliefs means reconsidering all that entire order, ideology, belief system. And so they're still entrenched in everything that they believed when they were in their 20s and 30s. But, you know, Shah's era was full of tormenting dichotomies. Tormenting in the sense that, especially when you look back from the perspective of, you know, decades, 4 or 5 decades, you see that so many things had transformed in ways that really changed the destiny of Iran. Now, what do I mean? Iran was a country that was so divided by various tribes and, you know, small groups that were guarding their own interests throughout the country. And the rise of the Pahlavi dynasty brought about a sense of national identity that had not existed in Iran for a couple of centuries. You know, Iran had a very glorious past, the Persian Empire, one of the world's greatest civilizations. But it had also suffered under the rule of the Qajars, which was the dynasty that preceded the Pahlavis, and for about 200 years. And so the country had been torn apart by monarchical mismanagement, and the Russians had been plundering the Iranian resources from the north, and then the British Empire was in the south, and so the country was really in a way torn apart, not just between two great foreign powers, but also between all these tribal leaders, because everybody was out for their own interests. And so I think, perhaps in my view, one of the greatest contributions of the Pahlavi dynasty was to bring the country together and create a sense of Iranianness. And the father of the Shah, who fell in the revolution of 1979, made great strides in that regard. He was one of the first monarchs ever. You know, if anybody else had done it before him, it has not been recorded. So he was the first monarch to actually visit a synagogue in Iran. And the idea behind this was that...
Thanks for listening to this preview of our latest podcast. To hear the full podcast episode and gain access to all our articles and podcasts, we invite you to become a Quillette subscriber. To find out more, visit Quillette.com. That's Quillette.com, and click on the subscribe button. That's Quillette.com, and then click subscribe. We look forward to having you as part of our community. If you're already a Quillette subscriber, go to the FAQ section of our website and click on How to Add Your Private Podcast Feed to Your Favorite Podcast App for instructions on how to access full episodes of this podcast.